from the heart of Los Angeles, this is the online edition of the Life Changes Show.
Look at the bright lights. Look at the bright lights.
With tonight's guest, molecular biologist, triathlete, and founder of Brain One, Thorne Steven.
Look at the night sky.
And performance guest, Joseph Eve. I am Mark Legere, and now our host, the MC, the master of change, Filippo Voltaggio.
I was driving the other day. I was stopped behind a car at a red light, waiting for the light to change. And for some reason, all of a sudden, I sensed like I was feeling a little bit anxious, just a little bit. I was puzzled. I couldn't think of a reason why I would be anxious. I wasn't in any particular hurry. I wasn't like waiting for the light to change or something. I looked around my car to see if maybe there was some kind of danger lurking around. There was no danger, thankfully. I looked in the rearview mirror. I saw that there was an inconspicuous car behind me, nothing to be alarmed about. And then it hit me. The car behind me was lower than me. And that reminded me I was on a hill. And sure enough, I was stopped on a hill. Now, without getting into the potentially very funny, very interesting story about my learning how to drive a manual transmission. And for those people who don't know what that is, stick shift, with a brand new car, wherein I was soon after kind of learning on a hill in San Francisco that's known for the steepest hills maybe in the world. So without getting into that story, I had a little trauma and I don't think about it and I don't find myself on a lot of hills. And so here I was, I'm like, oh, well, I like the actual manual transmission so much that the next car I bought was also manual transmission. So it's not that I wouldn't mind having another one. I'd like it. But I'm actually in an automatic right now. So a lot less reason to be concerned, on top of which I've since learned to maneuver hills with manual as well. So why the anxiety? It's a memory. It was a little bit of a fear-based memory coming back to me, which brings in the title, at least, of our episode, Unraveling How to Better Overcome Fearful Memories. However, what is interesting that I didn't think about until exploring our guest's work, and I got to thinking about something he talks about, and I'm sure we'll get to talk about today, micro habits. Why am I not parked on a hill very often? Because without really thinking about it, there are not a lot of hills where I live, but when there are hills, I make an unconscious, kind of conscious, or little both, micro habit, of just stopping at the bottom of the hill, waiting for the light to change if it's safe to do so, or kind of pulling up above the hill a little bit so that when the light changes, if I'm the first car there, or just avoiding the hill altogether. And I don't think about this often, but that's because the micro habits are working in the unconscious. And therein lies the question, because this is just a little example of one little thing that doesn't really happen a lot in my life. But what about the other little things that start to pile up that do happen a lot in my life? And how many micro habits do I have that are safeguarding me from perceived dangers, real or not, or relevant or not, to my life at the moment? And I wonder, starting today. I wonder, thanks to our guest, what will my life be like when I could manage those micro habits away from taking care of all those things onto the things that are actually much more important and relevant to me right now?
I wonder if your micro habit was to keep you from having to walk up the hill.
I was in a car. I didn't have to walk up the hill.
Oh, I thought you were parking the car.
No. I was parked at a light. I was stopped.
Fair enough. To be continued. I can't wait for tonight's show. Thorne is a friend and a respected colleague and way, way, way ahead of the market with Brain One and what they're up to and how they're looking at things. And, you know, we talk so much about reprogramming and repetition and habits and affirmation, but to get down to this granular level and starting to look at different nuances where we, you know, it's like the picture of the crowd trying to get up the escalator while the stairs are wide open and one person's walking up the stairs. There's just things that people are on autopilot for, and it's in all areas of life. So can't wait for this conversation.
Indeed. So I heard in the introduction, Mark, you said how he's a this and a that. There are so many things on the list of what he is. But for the sake of this introduction, I'm going to say our interview guest is digital strategist and data scientist, Thorne Stevens. Welcome to the show, Thorne.
Hey, guys. How we doing?
It's great. And it's great that you're on. It's great that we're having this conversation. I realize that this is a conversation that's going to be new to a lot of people, because some of what we're going to talk about is actually new to the world because you're bringing it, right? Cool.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Sorry. No, thank you. Did you see how you inspired the monologue today?
Yes, absolutely. Let's talk about fear extinction, and we can dive in there.
And get it taken care of it and move on.
Well, we can talk about the tools. You know, it's not necessarily one direct linear problem, so to speak, to solve, but we can definitely talk about the types of tools that would be helpful in such a situation.
Okay, good. So before we dive into that, and we will, I think it's quite interesting that you, who have so many interests, along with what Mark said, not only athletic, but you're a music composer and other things that we may talk about a little later. How do all of these things come into play to your life experience so far?
Thank you. Yeah, that's a great question. So music was introduced when I was quite young. My father was a musician. So it was a bit instilled through that. However, he was a guitarist and I played drums, and I never wanted to play with guitarists for that reason. But so quite early I was in marching band, and it was learning how to play drums, you know, in large groups and actually controlling rhythm and thereby controlling energy and vibration that I really began to see the power of music. Actually, I became a molecular biologist. My academic research is in biotechnology, and I've done drug development. But I actually believe it was from the structured framework of music that ultimately laid the foundation for my passions in science.
Wow. Now, molecular biologists do end up on the chemical side of a lot of big companies. You were not on the chemical company side, but you were with a lot of big companies. And what were you doing there?
So started my career as a molecular biologist doing essentially bench scientist in biotech. So we were focused in small molecule drug therapeutics and looking for novel mechanisms of action, let's say in cellular division to ultimately help downregulate or upregulate, depending on what we were looking at, specific molecules that could have an impact either in infectious disease or in cancer and so forth. And so very much a researcher at my core, and worked in biotech for a number of years. And that really laid the foundation again of measurement and using data to drive insights to drive hypotheses, and then, essentially experimentation, hypothesis testing and so forth. And I took that general framing out of biotech. And as I moved to Venice well over 10 years ago now, this is about 2010, there's the beginning of the tech movement in Southern California. I had a really, kind of, I would say, bit of a different background than, most people in LA. There's actually only one biotech in Los Angeles, or at least at the time. And so, my gravitation was towards, measurement, essentially online measurement of humans through, digital ecosystems, media measurement, but really just hyper-focused in all things measurement. And similar to the work in biotech, what I found is that through rapid iteration and testing, and again, using insights or data to drive insights, insights drive hypotheses, and rapid iteration, you could really trigger any action essentially from a human, whether it's watching more videos online or buying more things or X, Y, or Z. So that general framing I've applied to a number of industries, both at Fortune 100 companies all the way down. But that was the general strategy.
When you're looking at data and so much data, how does it speak to you? Do you see patterns? What do you see? What are you sensing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, pattern recognition is, I would say, definitely an integral part of the work. Generally, to oversimplify, you're looking at a baseline, and then you're looking at something that again may upregulate, downregulate, a specific action or response, whatever it might be. So yeah, I think that's kind of the oversimplified explanation is definitely looking at patterns.
So that went on to inform what we're going to be talking about in a little bit. But you shared with me something that kind of blew my mind, especially at the age that you started experiencing certain things. Like from the structure that you're talking and the data that you're talking and the way that you're using your mind scientifically, and then you're using it at your body along with it athletically, then you're using it musically. And then you also were introduced to plant medicine, or were you introduced, or how did you come to plant medicine?
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in a small town south of San Francisco, and I had an older sister, and so I was exposed to medicines of all kind at an earlier age, 12, 13. And when I was about 14 years old, I was in the upper Amazon of Ecuador, a town called Vilcabamba, which is outside of Loja. And so this is the upper Andes, still the Amazon, but not quite as quite as gnarly as the lower Andes or the lower Amazon. Was visiting, and at that time, we were going, that's when the Grateful Dead was still around. So we were going to see the Grateful Dead. We were also going to, raves in San Francisco and hip hop shows and kind of all aspects of experimentation. And long story short, I met some hippies and I was like, hey, are there any psilocybin mushrooms around? And they're like, no, but there's San Pedro. And like time slowed, and this guy mentioned that I needed to find the blue door in town in Vilcabamba, and we took that information, and we were staying outside in the jungles. And the next morning, we got up and we basically traipsed through the jungles into town, about 2 or 3 miles, and we looked for the blue door, essentially in the cobblestone streets of Vilcabamba. Scouting up and down, and it's a very small town. I mean, this is also got in the 90s, so even smaller then. And ultimately, we found the blue door, and there was a group of old men, and they were maybe in their I don't know, their 90s or so. I mean, actually, and it turns out humans in this it's considered a blue zone. Humans live to well over like 100 regularly, and basically bought the Wachuma, also known as San Pedro, from a local practitioner. And it was about, I think it was 10,000 sucres at the time, which was about $3. And we got 4 of these bags and ultimately drank them on the way back into the jungle. And that was my first foray into plant medicines.
Wow. So I know that it didn't stop there, and so I'm thinking you have explored the mind from molecular biology to chemistry, musically, and now like out of your mind in a sense through plant medicine. So all of this has now informed this next step of your evolution, it feels like.
Oh yes, absolutely. I mean, that moment in particular, and then the The subsequent experiences with plant medicines were definitely very transformative, to say the least. And I generally oversimplify the world in four major quadrants. You have spirit, you have science, you have art, and physiology or athleticism and so forth. And so I look at each, independently and really try to optimize each of them to a degree. And through, the work with plant medicines in particular, I began going to the jungles and, spending months and doing dietas in the Amazon. This was in the 2000s and 2010 forward and stuff. Doing fairly long. I mean, my longest ayahuasca dieta was 6 months, and technically that
Wow.
was ayahuasca and Tirik Sinango. So I did 3 months with Tirik, and then I did 3 months with Aya. And so 6 months, and that was called an omnidose protocol. And in the omnidose protocol, you basically do a microdose every 3 days, and then you do a macrodose, and then a microdose, and a macrodose. And I did that for 6 months. And the major thing I was looking for in that instance was stabilization of my nervous system. This was actually in the middle of COVID 2020. I'd been living in LA in Venice Beach for about 10 years, and I went screaming back to my home state of Colorado, and I needed to reset. And so my reset was this 6 month dieta, starting with Chitik Sonango and then going to Aya.
Wow. Wow. Well, thank you for sharing all of that. And so we're getting a picture here that you have systems that not maybe I'm getting a picture at least that not only comes from the data and the study of the brain, but also could it be like, I don't know, people call it downloads or you saw things in your experiences. Is that possible too?
Yeah, absolutely. I look at it as a foray into consciousness, ultimately, as I think about the multitude of plant medicines that I've had the opportunity to spend time with. And one of the general learnings and all of the experience with plants is that you don't even need the plants. You can experience these things through meditating in a cave or breath work or a number of other modalities. But my feeling is that plant medicines almost act as what we call in chemistry a catalyst, and it really can help reduce any barriers to get you there sooner. But yes, absolutely. I would say the plant medicines have definitely been flowing through my veins since an early age, and very transformative in shaping who I am as a human.
Now, say again, you simplified life into four categories.
Yeah, so I generally think about spirit. I think about science. I think about art. In my case, it's I'm a drummer, percussionist, but I've been composing music for 20, 30 years now. And then physiology. So I'm also a very active human. I've gone all the way up to Ironman distance triathlons, and on a weekly basis could do easily 100 miles plus on the bike, and whatever, 20, 30 miles running and so forth.
So,
And yeah,
yeah,
go ahead.
no, go on, go on.
No, and so as I think about these four quadrants, just what are the ways I can continue to learn and grow and enrich my own training? And the word I sometimes use is optimize, although I don't want that to get misconstrued. But I do think about how do you optimize spirit? And that's where some of my deeper work with plant medicines, like Aya as an example, come into play.
And so in the new the next level of your creation or the next creation we're going to be talking about, which is Brain One, you break things down into like three categories or like the protocol, the micro habits. What is that?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so the genesis for Brain One came out of some research I was doing with a group out of Columbia University. And what I saw it with that group was that, again, in general, the brain is just really underrepresented. You hear a lot about people looking to lose weight, maybe improve their heart health. You don't necessarily hear a lot about people wanting to improve their brain health when it is, absolutely one of the most important organs that we have. And so as I was going down that road, I was also, evaluating longevity, and more so than anything, it was really for me regrounding into my purpose of science, to be clear. And it was just very kind of unequivocal as I started to look at, these just areas, this white space, again, brain being one, longevity being another. Just what I thought was really underserved was the idea of brain, and specifically brain optimization. And while I was going down that road and in researching, we began to think about, some of the AI models we could build. And I was training for the Malibu Triathlon. And And as brain one started to come together, even before I'd really fully officially formed the company, I pulled together a triathlon team and we raced the Malibu Triathlon last season. And it was through that training process, though, that I was really thinking about optimizing the brain and optimizing my own biology. And, you know, I would say I began running in college and then I began, you know, doing, I mean, starting literally with a Susan G. Komen 10K, and then I went to a half marathon and then a marathon and then to a, you know, my half Ironman and then a full Ironman and just went down that road. But what really put it over the top was the ability to optimize biology. And fundamentally, by doing it with a device such as a wearable, you know, minimally just starting with heart rate, you know, and this was, you know, whatever, 10 plus years ago now, but then getting into the, you know, more advanced like heart rate variability and resting heart rate and so forth. But just the concept of optimizing your biology again through data. And that was really the genesis for Brain One. And so just to oversimplify what Brain One is, it's the idea that we all have a health protocol, every single one of us, you know, Mark, Filippo, like, and to oversimplify, what is a health protocol? Well, it can just be what you do in your day-to-day. You know, when you wake up in the morning, do you have, you know, a set of things that you do every morning? And so for me, it's going to be things like getting direct sun exposure. It's going to be proper hydration. It's some level of prayer. It's some level of meditation. And then I usually begin my engineering calls with India. And then I go through, you know, some sort of a really long, you know, couple hour exercise, da da da. And so, you know, essentially each of those, you know, pieces of your routine or what I call a protocol is considered a micro habit. And so in your day to day, in your week to week, month to month, you know, you're doing a series of micro habits. And so just to oversimplify Brain One, you have the idea of the health protocol comprised of micro habits, and then the idea of measurement and feedback loops. You know, as a scientist and even as an early budding data scientist, I had a mentor who said you cannot manage what you cannot measure. And I always thought that was pretty profound. And so, you know, fundamentally ensuring that we have some level of measurement of the biology as we're looking at, you know, brain or, you know, early on when I was looking at just, you know, attenuating my lactic threshold in triathlon as an example. But it all ultimately comes down to data.
So, all right, so you have a protocol. Let's say you wake up in the morning and you do, let's say you brush your teeth. Now, the micro habits leading up to the brushing of the teeth, are you talking like how you put the toothpaste on and how long you brush or what's.
Not, no, it would be more, not necessarily, you know, I mean, hygiene could be a micro habit, so that's fair. I mean, that's something fair to call out. Like for it's generally a specific activity that ideally has, you know, some sort of an outcome. And so as an example, like, you know, very pertinent to every human being is, you know, ultimately getting sunlight first thing in the morning, unobstructed if possible, you know, outdoors. 10 minutes roughly should be sufficient. And, you know, that's an example again of a micro habit. And then what is the measured outcome? Well, you know, it absolutely helps with, you know, your circadian, you know, essentially resetting your circadian rhythms as an example. So if you're traveling, you know, doing something like the, you know, the morning sunlight can be very beneficial. But that would be more of an example of a micro habit. Or again, you know, meditation. It could almost be anything. And in Brain One, we actually have people submitting their own micro habits, which has been really interesting in hearing people's stories about, you know, their grandfather's micro habits that they now use on a daily basis.
Interesting. And so what kind of feedback does one get? So part of this is potentially a wearable, right?
Yep, absolutely. So when you talk about brain measurement, I generally think of things in a spectrum. And over here on the left, we could have, you know, essentially what's called self-report. How are you feeling today? And, you know, that would be a subjective measure. How are you feeling? I'm feeling good or bad. You know, one of the challenges with brain and in really the mind or, you know, the, you know, just mental health in general, it's a lot harder to quantify how someone is feeling. And so how you do that again are through clinical, you know, essentially subjective measures. So as an example, if you have a human who is undergoing or, you know, is diagnosed with depression, you can use what's called GAD-7. And so that's a self-report, you know, essentially it's like, how are you feeling today? It's a series of questions specific to general anxiety and depression. So self-report is probably, the most, in some ways rudimentary, but, our vision at BrainOne is to reach 1 billion humans and help optimize their brains. And in order to do that, you have to have some level of self-report, because some humans can't afford, wearables, just to be blunt. But as you, again, kind of progress across the spectrum, so you have self-report, you have clinical measures, then you have biometrics. And so biometrics have gotten, fairly cheap all in all, but you can get them out of your phone, you can get them out of a wearable. I use several when I'm training. I might use Aura for sleep, and I use Garmin for activity. My daily is an Apple Watch. And sometimes I'll do time series, and I'll actually have multiple watches on and just to see which one is the most accurate. But you have, essentially biometrics, and then you get into biomarkers. So that's kind of on the left side of the spectrum. Again, you have self-report, you have biometrics, you have biomarkers. And then all the way at the other side of the spectrum of brain, you have what are called BCIs. And these are called brain-computer interfaces. And a BCI essentially is a chip. And you guys, I'm sure, have heard of Neuralink. Yeah, it's probably the most famous in the news. However, it's certainly not the oldest. And there's an amazing company called BlackRock Neuro out of Utah. And they've been building these chips for, I think, over 20 years now. And more so, my chief scientist at BrainOne, he actually is, he qualified for a clinical trial at Caltech. And he has six of these chips actually on his brain at the moment. And so these are called BCIs, or brain-computer interfaces. And what these are doing is, these chips in particular, so they're essentially 8 by 8. So they have 64 nodes per chip. And they're both measuring the neural activity as well as the ability to excite, certain areas of the brain. And my chief scientist, Dr. Galen Buchwalter, he's an amazing pioneer. He actually has six of these at the moment, and one in the prefrontal cortex. And it may be the first human in history to actually have one in the prefrontal cortex. So it's amazing in terms of where we're at. And quite literally, in the case of BCIs, this is the intersection of biology and machines. And it is right now. It's not in the future. It's literally happening today. And it's all around us. And the vision of Neuralink is that someday everyone could be chipped. And it's not totally inaccurate. And so we're actively working again on how you would integrate such data from a BCI.
So it's collecting data. What does it do with the data?
In the case of the BCIs, or in the case of
Yeah, the
what?
BCIs.
So, in the case of the BCIs, now Galen is a he has this very specific use case. He's unfortunately a quadriplegic. He was paralyzed when he was 17, and so in his instance, he's the BCIs are doing brain mapping. So he's doing brain exercises, and one of the exercises is to visualize gripping, like let's say, a green ball. And so he says that out loud, and then he's and they're measuring the brain activity. And basically, what they're doing is they're it's like advanced brain mapping. So you're actually literally seeing when Galen is thinking about grabbing the green ball or saying, "I am grabbing the green ball," what happens within the electro activity of his brain. And long story short, that then is pulled into an AI with the vision that in the future he could use his brain and say, "Grab the green ball with a robotic arm." So that's a very practical use case of how these models are going from literally the brain reading into an AI, and then ultimately into a use case that could better millions of humans' lives.
So this is in study mode. As a matter of fact, Brain One is in beta.
Yeah, so BrainOne is in beta. And to be clear on that, we're the most focused over on the left side of the curve. We're focused on self-report, we're integrating wearables, and then we're now looking at really fun things like biomarkers and seeing through these protocols, can we upregulate down really specific biomarkers that would have a impact in brain health, as an example.
And so brain health, let's talk about that a little bit. It's not just how we feel, it's how we think, it's how we're able to do things, right?
Yep, absolutely.
Anything else that I
Well, yeah, so it's important as we talk about, brain health versus brain optimization. We currently are more focused in the brain optimization side, meaning if someone, has been diagnosed with Alzheimer's or dementia, we're not specializing in that right now. However, if someone comes to the site and they fill out a form and that's what they're looking for, we could absolutely help push them in the right direction. And we're actually looking at actually helping clinical trials to some degree. So So generally, when you talk about brain health, you could also talk about things like neurodegeneration, right? And Alzheimer's and dementia are usually the two that
Well.
people are the most concerned with. And I was just flying in from into Aspen today from LA, and I was with a 70-year-old woman, and she started talking to me. And I brought up, she asked what I was working on. She, anyway, da da da, and you could tell I was a scientist or something. And she went right to the brain, and had a number of questions there. And so a woman in her 70s, she was looking for tools essentially. And the reality is, a lot of the tools that are available now, you obviously have genetic predisposition for certain things like Alzheimer's. But there is also the impact of the environment. And in the case of dementia, there are many scientists and researchers that believe that it's preventable, or at least to a certain stage, it's preventable. And by adopting again a protocol that is focused in, yes, brain health is important, but just the foundation of health first. So you need to be sure you're getting the right amount of sleep, the right amount of hydration, the right amount of nutrition, potentially supplements that can then lay the foundation to optimize your brain and utilize some other tools or modalities that could again help support better brain function.
Thorin, I'm going to step in. I'm usually the one that's the eternal optimist, and I love the positivity around the technology and the limitless upside, so many applications. But last time I checked, we're in a world where not everyone thinks the way we do. And I'm curious, with the minute technology's embedded, you can hijack planes and fly them remotely. What keeps somebody from hijacking a chip and being able to walk that person in a direction, so to speak?
Yeah, absolutely. And to be honest, even before we get to the chips, what humans listening to this should be concerned about is, the collection and use of their brain activity,
Right.
essentially. As a budding data scientist, I moved to LA, I'm working in, these organizations and have these, access to these massive amounts of data. Now, this is like, 2012 or so. We were the generation that gave away all of our behavioral data to the Metas and to the Googles and, the Amazons and the Apples and so forth. Like, it was us, and we did it under the guise of connecting with, maybe schoolmates, from our past and so forth. But all of our behavioral data has been given away. We are in, I mean, thousands, I don't know, millions of databases where our data has been commoditized and resold. It's happening all the time. Period, basically. And that's, again, specific to behavioral data. Now, there's medical data that has, because of HIPAA and some of the regulations, and there's pros and cons of HIPAA we can get into, but fundamentally, what I think people should be, the most immediately concerned with is, again, is the use of your brain data. And I'm not conspiratory, but is big tech coming after your brain? I mean, that's, I hear these discussions quite frequently. Again, I'm also an optimist, Mark. But I think fundamentally, humans should be aware of, how their data is being collected and where it's being used. So I think that is a more immediate concern that people, should be aware of. And as a quick example, I was here in Aspen and I did an EEG reading. So essentially, this is a brain cap. It's fairly low resolution, relative to, like, the kind of the spectrum. There's EEG and then there's QEEG. QEEG is what most, like, neurotherapists would use. But long story short, I did this brain mapping here in a coffee shop. It took about 20 minutes and I got about 15 pages of data. And the guy that
Wow.
did the mapping, was fairly smart, but he wasn't necessarily a scientist and couldn't really help me interpret the data. But my point being is that, these EEGs and this type of, again, brain measurement is only going to become more and more prevalent. So those are some of the things we're thinking about relative to, like, the storage of such, brain data. So just to be clear, I think that's a bigger concern. But then further, down the road, when these types of augmentations are more common, yeah, it's absolutely a concern, Mark. And I think, the only thing we can do is try to provide the safeguards, around the, accessibility. But yeah, you're not wrong. And it's like anything in science. I, as a molecular biologist, you can look at CRISPR and gene editing. I mean, there's so many ways science can be used nefariously or for good. And we try to stick to the side of the good.
Well, it's a challenging topic, but I would imagine it'll be much easier to hack one of those chips than to decipher my brain activity.
You are
So,
probably correct on that one. Actually, that's an interesting frame.
well, I, this is obviously it feels like a teaser conversation because there's so much there's so much to this conversation, and the fact that Brain One is still in beta. So we'll obviously want to know lots more, Thorn. In the meantime, though, as we're wrapping this up, unraveling how to better overcome fearful memories. I know there are tools, and it applies where we have this, how did you call it? The protocols, the micro habits, and the feedback loops, right? That's all in play, right?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Without getting too over-indexed in the, you know, the nerdiness of the science. So there's a really interesting research study, which we could share, by the way, guys, we'd be happy to. And the research is around the, you know, the connection between REM sleep and what is called the infralimbic cortex. And the infralimbic cortex, it's a cortical region, essentially, it's near the prefrontal cortex of the brain, long story short. And it has been associated with fear. And so what that means is, you know, generally fear responses. So specifically, this research in particular looked at the impact of REM sleep and then intralimbic essentially inhibition. And so what it found is that if you could essentially suppress the activity of the intralimbic cortex during REM sleep after a fear-inducing event is the nutshell. And so what this means ultimately is that you could just oversimplify it. You wouldn't, let's say, like feel the memories deeply. And so the connection between the IL and then ultimately REM sleep. And so one of the take-home messages is just, again, really the importance of REM sleep. And, you know, that's kind of like the high level. And so how do you measure REM? Well, you can now measure REM almost through, you know, nearly any wearable has this breakdown. And you can really focus on how much REM you're getting per night, or again, after a specific incident, you know, there is a, you know, there could be a benefit of really trying to accelerate or really trying to increase the amount of REM, rapid eye movement sleep you're getting every evening, essentially.
Well, thank you for that. It's exciting to me to think of all the different aspects of the brain that you have studied and experienced and are on which you're collecting data as well, that you have suggestions, and there's opportunity for so much more of what ails people or ills people. So it'll be exciting to learn more. If you do share that study with us, we could share it in a blog post or something.
Absolutely.
And then again, there's more for sure. In the meantime, brain.one, that's O-N-E, brain.one is where this beta test is happening, and people can sign up. And what else happens once
That's awesome. Yeah, they can sign up for our beta. And right now it's a free public beta. And we can talk you through the process of creating a protocol and working towards optimizing your brain health.
What do you mean, what happens? They get a brain upgrade, Filippo.
Well, you got to do the work. That's the thing, guys. There's no magic
pill. Oh, there's work.
But we can provide the framework for you and the listeners to, you know, ultimately follow. But that's always the hardest part here. It's usually not the technology or the machines. It's the humans.
Wait till we get to brain 7, brain 8.
Yeah, exactly.
You skip 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. Thorn, what an absolute pleasure it was to get to have you share as you have about brain.one for those who want to learn more or sign up for the beta. And we have several links for Thorn on our website, including a couple articles already there in social media, etc., and a couple other websites where you can learn more about him and his background and what he's up to. There will be so much more for sure. Thorn Stevens, thank you so much.
Awesome. Thank you guys so much. Appreciate it.
Appreciate you. All the
best. Before we move on, Filippo, I'm gonna give EPX Global a quick shout out, because clearly somewhere, I think it's in the Cambridge Dictionary, if you look up overachiever, Thorne's there. and it's a perfectly great example of the community that Paul Kirchhoff's been creating. So it's great to know Thorne.
Thank you. Agreed. And with that, we have our Ask Dorothy segment.
Dear Dorothy, this is Mike from La Jolla, and I am still the assistant manager in the apartment complex you once lived in. I have missed your sharing your insights and valuable information when I came to you with life questions. I trust you will be able to assist me with my present situation. I recently helped a lovely young woman move into our complex, and she and I hit it off, and she began texting me daily with questions, and I found her to be very flirtatious. 3 months later, she still texts me quite often, but it appears that she may be only interested in how I can assist her with her apartment issues. So my question is this: is this stunning woman flirting with me, or is she simply using me for helping her with her apartment needs? You have always told me that there is a gift in every situation, and I need to know if she is using me and how to break this pattern.
My dear friend, it appears that you are once again caught up in an old pattern that you have repeated for many years. However, the good news is that you are finally questioning this pattern and looking for truth. You are a very good man, and you have helped so many people in so many ways, and this is a great thing. And now I'm very excited for you as you are beginning to question the true intent in the interactions with this woman. If she was truly interested in being more personally connected with you, then she might have invited you in for coffee or even a meal as a thank you. However, it appears that she sees you only as the assistant manager and not as a man of personal interest to her. I feel the gift in this is that you are breaking free, finally, of an old pattern of being used by someone who does not have any intent to perform a more personal relationship with you. And this is a great step for you. I encourage you to continue assisting her as you assist in all in the building. And yet I ask that you do your best to free yourself from your old pattern of expecting more from this kind of connection. And I'm very excited for you, breaking free from many years of adhering to old patterns that do not serve. Congratulations.
Thank you, Dorothy. And if you have a question for Dorothy, please write her at AskDorothy@LifeChangesShow.com.
And we'll be right back with our performance guest, Joseph Eid, on the Life Changes Show Online Edition right after this.
The Little Dog That Could is the fantastically true story of a man and a little dog that came into his life as his mentor to help him understand the world beyond his human senses and to experience life, love, and healing beyond his human understanding. Best-selling author Filippo Voltaggio, who currently hosts the highly regarded Life Changes show, is an internationally known singer, speaker, and life coach. Filippo offers up his own story, how one little surprise package in fur and four legs transformed his life unexpectedly forever and furthered his path of self-discovery. In The Little Dog That Could, Filippo brings to life the meaning of the adage, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. Through the reading of this book, you will experience the journey of real miracles that transcend time, space, and logic while gaining practical tools that will help you navigate your way. The Little Dog That Could is available through Amazon and Barnes & Noble. For more information, visit thelittledogthatcould.com. That's thelittledogthatcould.com.
There are self-help seminars costing thousands of dollars guaranteeing miraculous transformations. There are compelling speakers and life-changing weekend experiences where you can walk on fire. They all deliver revelations that guarantee you'll come back for the more expensive revelations filled with even greater wonder next month on Fiji. We get addicted to positive, heartfelt, expensive theater. What we really need is a jumpstart, an awakening, someone who can give us a reminder that everything we need lies within. Through inspiration and practical knowledge, Dorothy Donahue helps people get grounded and motivated, inspired and energized. It's not just words and affirmations and the power of intention. It's a mindset brought about by a tangible, transcendental experience, an audio-visual, physical, spiritual experience that helps us realize we transform ourselves. We get tools to become the conscious co-creators of lives of unlimited potential. Find out more. Go to DorothyDonahue.com.
You are listening to A Conversation That Matters on The Life Changes Show. Broadcasting live from the heart of Los Angeles every Monday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Share the journey with us at lifechangesshow.com and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Life Changes Show.
Our performance guest is a folk pop artist, singer, songwriter, and live performer. Welcome, Joseph Eade, to the Life Changes Show.
Hello, hello.
It's so exciting to have you. When I first was introduced to your music by a friend, Will Peterson, I thought, wow, it's folk music again for today. Storytelling and all of that. Little did I know that that has a history for you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's it goes back to like when I was 5 years old, I think.
Okay, tell us.
Yeah, well, you know, for me, it started with poetry. I remember, you know, growing up, I'm originally Lebanese. You know, I come from a Lebanese family that immigrated to the United States. But I thought it was always normal that families shared poetry. That's how I grew up. You know, like my grandfathers on special occasions would write poetry. Someone's born, they write a poem. A birthday, they write a poem, they share it. My father did the same. My mother did the same. My grandmother's aunts and uncles. It was just like kind of a normal thing. And I remember I was, I think, 5 or 6 years old, and we were on the beach. We went away for a weekend. And I just remember like one of my earliest memories, just wanting to write about the experience. Mm. And then I just, this kid asked my dad if I could share it with all their friends. And I think I knew at that moment, you know, I really enjoy processing life and taking experience and patterns and putting things together and putting it in form and sharing it, you know, and having it be like an insight that comes through. And that's kind of what it's developed into. And I think folk music and, you know, singer-songwriters in general, that's kind of what we're about. You know, we have something in us that we didn't choose. It chose us. We don't feel like we have a choice in the matter. It was a calling that we have to do this. You know, we have to kind of share these insights and these, our view of life, and maybe other people will connect with it.
Well, talk about something that you don't feel like you choose. I'm sorry, I don't mean to be laughing, yeah. But I am thinking of your parents saying, I thought you were going to be a doctor. You were on your way. And you were actually on your way.
I seriously was. And that was a defining moment in my life. And nothing was ever the same after I dropped out. So like, I always had this artist spirit, if you want to call it that, you know, and always kind of grew up in a home, traditional home, where, you know, hey, it's a great hobby, good, you know, do the music, do the singing in the high school chorus or whatever, musicals, but you're not going to going to pay for this. Like, that's not a respectable or a promising or stable job, right? So it kind of wasn't in my consciousness that I would have the nerve to actually do it. And I went to college. I went to Stony Brook, which was a very science, you know, oriented school. I was majoring in psychology because that was something I thought, okay, if I can't really do the music artist thing, I'll study psychology. At least that has some kind of, for me, it felt artistic in a way because it was just like understanding humans. And then I thought, you know, I had a lot of friends that were doing pre-med. So I started doing pre-med. I'm like, well, maybe I could just go all the way and be a doctor and make my parents happy, make my dad happy, and kind of hide away for another 7 years. and that was the plan, you know. I was running away from a lot of things. And I'll never forget, you know, I went back for the second semester, and I did well. I mean, I did well my first semester. I'm like, I can do this if I really want to.
You're adding insult to injury, right?
Yeah. I was like, I can do this. But I knew something was off when everybody at the school would like get together and watch ER and stuff on Thursdays. And I was like, I don't want to do this. I want to like be writing poetry or singing with, you know, because there were a couple of artists in the school and stuff. So anyway, to make a very long story short, sorry, is the second semester, I remember studying microbiology one day, and the thought process started. It was like a snowball effect. I thought, what if you could do whatever you wanted to do? What if in this life, this experience, you were going to do it your way? What would that look like? And I started running with this idea and I thought, oh my God. And then I just like, my whole body just started like, I just started feeling these amazing sensations. And I thought, oh my God, I'm gonna wake up tomorrow morning. I'm gonna go to my student advisor and ask for a leave of absence, knowing full well I was never coming back. Like, it was literally one of those moments where I just had kind of a breakthrough. And it was brave, I'm telling you, to go back home and have to face your family and all your friends who bought you a stethoscope and had a farewell party for you. Oh, it is not fun. But I did it. I moved to Manhattan and I was set on making this dream come true.
Is it like a wedding when people get divorced within a year or something, they have to give the gifts back? You had to give the stethoscope back?
No, I kept it.
And the microscope?
I kept it as a reminder to never, ever do anything that is not in your heart.
Wow. Because
that seriously leads, I've seen it, I've witnessed it, wow, a lot of people around me, it leads to a miserable life. I never wanted to blame my parents or blame anybody for my life. I wanted to take responsibility. And I was like, if this doesn't work out, I will blame myself and I'll be happy about it. But I don't want to be one of these guys that says, oh, you, it's because of you, my life sucks. And I was like, no, we're not doing that.
Joseph, knowing the two songs you're going to sing, I'm thinking, oh, so this is where the song Thank You comes. Mm-hmm. But then he's got Misunderstood. Well, maybe it's that one. So we're going to do Thank You first. But
all right.
Does it apply to that story?
Yeah, honestly, that this song applies to anything like that. I mean, anyone who's ever gone through a challenging time of any kind, really, just for us to be in a place now where we can look back and go, you know what? It was hard, but it's still beautiful because it's a story and it's our story and it got us to where we are now. So I say thank you to all of it.
Wow. Well, thank you. Here is Joseph Eade's pre-recorded song here on the Life Changes Show. Thank you.
This is a thank you to all those who came before, who brought doubts, who brought darkness, a desire for something more. To the fakes, to the flakes, and to every closing door. You are not mistakes, no, you're what I'm grateful for. When I walk on by with my head held high, I'm aware of the weight that I left behind. When you said no, yeah, you set me free. Didn't know that this road had something better to give me. I love you so good, I love you so bad. I see you now as two sides of the same track. I love you so good, I love you so bad. I raise a glass, I laugh when I look back. And all you traded in for what you thought was love was just a string of faded moments that never felt. Did you know life had a much larger piece in store? If you could only let go of the crumbs you're begging for. When you walk on by, hold your head up high, and know that all of your loss will be your light. Like a newfound key, it will set you free. To be whole, to be loved is your destiny. I love is a thank you to all those who came before, who brought doubts and who brought darkness, a desire for something more. I love you so good, I love you so bad. I see you now, it's two sides of the same track. I love you so good, and I love you so bad. I raise a glass, I laugh, and I look back. And I look back.
Joseph Eid. Find him on all the socials at Joseph Eid Music on YouTube as well. We have all the links for him. He's got his website at josepheidmusic.com, josepheidmusic.com. Joseph, we were having such a great conversation earlier today, and we were laughing about so many aspects of life and growing up and the various cultures that you've experienced and all of that. And I don't know, something made me ask you, are your parents still with us? And then you told me something that I just, I'm like, how could we be laughing so much? Yeah. How could he do it? I mean,
Yeah, my dad, last year, my dad passed away, and so did my brother. So it was definitely the hardest year of my life and my entire family. So it was, it was a difficult time. And, just made me realize that, you don't know how strong you are, you know, until you're faced with certain things. You don't know what you're capable of doing until, you know, life basically shows you.
You came out of that experience, or you are, or were having during that experience, some interesting thoughts that, if you don't mind sharing, I thought were very profound.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you, when we lost my brother, which was kind of unexpected, you know, he got diagnosed with cancer and passed very quickly, and it was a shock to everybody. I just remember when it happened, I just was thinking, there's no way this can be real. Like, there's no way this experience is really all there is, because it wouldn't really make any sense. Like, it was too painful. And then in that moment, I just thought, this is some kind of role that we're all playing, and we get to swap out roles, and one day we're all going to see each other again, and we're going to say, hey, remember that life when I played that role and then you learned that, or when I did this and you learned that? And it brought me a lot of comfort, because I do think that we only see a very like thin dimension of what's really happening. And I like to think that no one ever really, you know, leaves. It's just, you know, they move on to somewhere else and we can't see them. And one day we will understand everything. But it's, you know, it just made me realize how much our society, we don't talk about this enough, because, you know, when it all went down, it was like, nothing can prepare you for that. And I thought, you know, I wasn't prepared for it. None of my family was. So yeah, I mean, if that can bring any, you know, solace to anybody out there who's experienced that, or, you know, it helped me out. And I wrote about it.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. You wrote about it, and you're in the process of recording a song about it. So please let us know when it's out so that we can share it with our audience.
Definitely, definitely. It's going to be out in September. So it's just, you know, it's how I cope. And I think everybody has their way. And you got to hope that you pick a way that's, you know, that's helpful for you.
Thank you, Joseph. Thank you for sharing that. As we're drawing our time together to a close here, and we get to hear one more song from you. Speaking of coping, you have used your music as a way already, not only to share, but to cope with life's difficult moments, some moments that we all might experience. Is this next song in that vein?
Yes, actually. I think they all are in a way. It's this next song is called Misunderstood, and it's just about, it's a song about telling the truth and how it can be very, very messy. And it happened to me, you know, in relationship with somebody close to me where I was a little too honest because I cared enough about someone to be real. And when you do that, sometimes you have to risk temporary alienation, and that's what happened. So it's a song about how telling the truth is a great idea, but sometimes, you know, it gets messy and it hurts. And we live in a world where people have a lot of trauma and aren't always ready to hear it.
Well, we're ready to hear the song. So
all right.
Here is Joseph's pre-recorded song, Misunderstood, here on the Life Changes Show Online Edition.
I have found when the walls come down, when the heart feels free to be seen, when romantic fools let their guards down, when they say what they mean. It gets messy, messy fast. I wish somebody taught me how to hold. Upside down, but to be honest, can be such a crime. And if it hurts, if it burns, they will lock you out, so you can't tell the truth all the time. It gets messy when you ask, and I answer as a matter of.
Boy, isn't that the question of a lifetime? Thank you for that. JosephHydeMusic.com is where you can find him, and you can follow him at Joseph Hyde Music on all the socials. And that's Joseph and then EID music.com. Joseph, there is so much more about you. I know we've only scratched the surface, but I trust that there will be more times and more music we can enjoy.
That'll be great. Thanks so much for having me. It was such a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure. I should tell everybody, if you go to the Life Changes Show website page and look for Joseph, we have a great video, Watch It Fall. Oh, there's a story there too, right? Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
But they'll have to wait for the next time.
Yep.
In the meantime, there are plenty of other videos on YouTube and on the socials. Joseph, all the best to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night. And with a big thank you to Joseph Eid and another big thank you to our guest, our interview guest, Thorne Stevens. That is our show. On behalf of our executive producer, Dorothy Lee Donahue, and our executive producer and co-host, Mark LeJure, I am your host, Filippo Voltaggio, reminding you that as your life changes, like ours surely did tonight, we're here for you. Ciao, everyone.
You have been listening to the Life Changes Show on the BBS Radio Network. Listen live every Monday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Time and visit us online at lifechangesnetwork.com, on Facebook at the Life Changes Show, and on Twitter at Life Changes Show. Join us again next week as we consciously explore and embrace the only constant, life changes. The Life Changes Network is an entertainment network. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and participants and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Life Changes.